This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Three friends of accused Boston Marathon bomber Zahar Tsarnaev appeared in federal court today. They're charged with tampering with evidence. They were in court to file a slew of pretrial motions, including a request to move their trials outside of Massachusetts.
WBUR's Bruce Gellerman is at the Moakley Federal Courthouse and joins us now. Hi there, Bruce.
Hello, Meg.
So we mentioned one of the charges that these three former students face. Can you just remind us what else they have been charged with, first of all?
Obstruction of justice, conspiracy to obstruct justice. Those are the two Kazakhs, Diaz Kazakbayev and Azamat Tazayakov. Rubel Filipos, who's a U.S. citizen, is charged with lying to federal agents.
Okay. So today, defense attorneys for these three young men brought a change of venue motion. Essentially, they wanted their trials moved out of Massachusetts. How did Judge Douglas Woodlock, I should say, rule on that motion?
Well, Woodlawn, he kind of denied it, actually. What he said is, there's a direct quote, I think a properly vetted jury will be fair and impartial and can be chosen in a community where something, an extraordinary event took place. So what he's done, though, is he's going to allow a jury to be impaneled here in Boston, but he also suggested that he may have a backup jury set up in Springfield.
In Springfield, in case the trial does have to be moved out of Boston?
In case they even suggest they may even bring the Springfield jury here.
Wow. Okay. So it sounds as if there's, I mean, even though he didn't necessarily move, agree with their motion to move the trial, there may be preparations in case that has to happen.
Exactly.
Okay. So what about the motion that the defense attorneys brought to separate the trials and have these three young men tried separately rather than together?
Well, that hasn't been decided yet. The first motion that they dealt with actually was something called dismiss. They just wanted all three defense attorneys. So let's just dismiss the charges, and that the judge immediately denied. He just shot it down. There are a bunch of motions that are going to be decided, but those are the first two. And then there was the big one that happened late morning, and it just finished now. They were talking about whether it's a motion to suppress, and it gets a little technical, but I can explain it if you like.
Sure. So this is suppressing certain evidence that might be brought to trial later on.
Specifically, the statements that were made right after the FBI moved in to New Bedford and then also interviewed Filipos, Rubel Filipos, but basically the Kazakhs who were living in New Bedford at the time. And the FBI man who was in charge at the time, John Walker, testified. But I should say, let me back up just a little because it gets very interesting. That is that all three defendants had to file affidavits. And the way the affidavits usually move through this motion part of the trial is that they compel the government to have the burden of proof shifts to the government to answer to those affidavits. Well, the judge in this case, he said, no, we're not going to do it that way. You're going to have your clients testify. And they said, well, no, that's not the way it's done. You're the only judge that say in the whole federal district here in Boston, you're the only judge who's ever said that. And he says, well, that's the way we're doing it, basically. And only two of the defendants said, we're not going to do that, and even suggested that by doing that, there could be grounds for appeal. But Diaz Kazakbayev's attorney, Robert Stahl, he said, okay, I'll go for this. And that's what we've been doing late morning and just now. They've been interviewing or testifying an FBI man named John Walker, who's the one who took the testimony, who spoke to the two Kazakhs soon after during the manhunt, actually, in Watertown. They went in with a hostage rescue team down to the apartment in New Bedford, surrounded the place, and then interviewed the two suspects.
Well, so Bruce, we've just got a couple seconds to go, but just for clarification, this motion to suppress after this interesting back and forth between the judges and the defense attorneys, has it been fully decided?
It has been fully decided. Now, so what that means is that only one is being, there's only one, but they're both, all three are sitting in court watching the one defense attorney lead the questioning.
Okay.
But it will be three separate trials, Meghna.
Got it. And those trials begin June 30th, and then later in the year on September.
And then
the end of September. WBR's Bruce Gellerman, who attended today's pretrials hearings at the Moakley Courthouse. Thanks so much, Bruce.
You're welcome.
Brad Stevens is used to winning. But when we sat down with him earlier today to talk about his first season as head coach of the Boston Celtics, we spent a lot of time talking about losing. That's because this past season, the Celtics were a long way from their storied past. They lost 57 games and won only 25. For a guy who broke the NCAA record for most wins during his first 3 years as a college coach, losing is unfamiliar territory.
The losing season bothers me. You know, 25 and 57 doesn't sit well with anybody who's competitive, obviously. But I've never judged much based purely on results. I've judged it based on growth, on are we getting better? Are we moving in the right direction? Did we learn what we need to do so that we can be better the next time?
In fact, nobody expected Brad Stevens to lead the Celtics to another championship this year. With the departure of the big three, Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett, and Ray Allen, the team is in the midst of a rebuilding campaign. And the 37-year-old Stevens, the former head coach at Butler University in Indianapolis, is a key part of that. We spoke with the NBA's youngest coach about the challenges of the past season and his hopes for the next, and about this past weekend when he returned to Butler to receive an honorary degree and address the graduates.
I just participated and was a part of a season that didn't go very well. And I'll tell you this. The times of biggest adversity, at least of the groups that I've been a part of, have also been the times when the trampoline's the bounciest.
Was this past season one of those difficult times when perhaps the trampoline was the bounciest?
We'll find out. Yeah. You know, and I think that that's what you find out if this is something that you can reflect on and say, hey, did the guys in the program that were on this team, that will continue to be on this team, do they get better because of it or not?
I read a quote from Rajon Rondo. He did the best that he could do, a lot of different rotations thrown at him, a lot of guys that didn't play before. For the most part, he did an excellent job. Are you satisfied with that? I mean, does that make you feel somewhat satisfied?
It's nice of him to say that, but I've never coached in a season where I was satisfied with how it went yet, and I guess that's why you go and you get started again in September and try it again.
What's the biggest adjustment? What's been the biggest adjustment for you from going from a college coach to coaching in the NBA?
The biggest difference is the schedule. You start with training camp. You get 5 days before your first preseason game. The preseason games come in a flurry. Hit you like a ton of bricks. Then you get about a week to prepare for your first game, and then it's off and running. After that, you hardly ever get any practice time. I've got to do a better job of managing the early part of the season so that if we need to make tweaks and changes, we can do them more on the fly later on.
I heard you mention that this quote that, you know, it's not who I am, it's what I do. But I got to imagine that the kind of pressures that this kind of professional season puts on you, it does make you who you are.
Yeah, it bothers you. I think the experience obviously continues to build resilience in who you are as a person. And one of the things that I did learn was the approach doesn't change. Whether you're really good and you've won 25 straight games or whether you're not so good and you're fighting for your next win. That was a lens that I had never looked through because we had really never struggled in this, certainly to this extent, in the previous 6 years as a head coach. So I think it's good to know that the process stays the same. All the important things are still all the important things. We just have to get a lot better at all the important things.
Let me ask you a little bit about the draft, which is coming right up. You've spoken a lot about getting the right people on the bus. And so I'm wondering, as you look ahead toward the draft, what qualities you're looking for?
No, ultimately, I'm not the person that makes that ultimate decision. But what I really look for in players generally is, I think any team benefits from, obviously, great stewards of their community, great representatives of their organization, who, when they get between those lines, are competitive and tough and resilient. And I think that those qualities are going to stand out as we look in this year's draft.
You're known for your in-depth statistical analysis of players and games. You've been given a lot of credit for really bringing that sort of science to college basketball. The NBA has more than doubled the number of games in the typical college season, so I'm curious if it was hard to get up to speed and do all the prep necessary to really stay abreast of that statistical analysis.
So it wasn't hard to get up to speed, and the biggest difference is turning right around and playing another game the next day.
Right.
And I think that that's where, you know, I'd like to be really well versed in the opponent. And it's not hard for me to do that in 20 hours. It's hard to communicate what you need to communicate to the players in the right amount of dosage.
And are the players responsive to this kind of in-depth statistical analysis that you're known for?
Yeah, I don't go there and I don't go into the locker room and spew square roots or anything. You know, I think it's more about you go in there and you say, okay, you know, this guy drives left 75% of the time, and on the occasions where he drives right, he shoots a pull up, you know, 65% of the time. So I think that you manage that, you say it appropriately. You talk to each guy individually based on if they react to that or not.
You know, when talking to you, I was reading about your story and your background, and it's I don't think a lot of our listeners would know this about you, that when you got out of college, you went to work for Eli Lilly. You weren't basketball coaching, and you actually started as a volunteer coach working basically for free. At what point did it become clear that this was where you were going to go?
Well, I was working at Eli Lilly and making a very good living doing that right out of college. But I was 22 years old or 23 years old and wasn't really inspired by the day-to-day operations of being a marketing associate at a farm company. Mm. I learned a ton, and I look back on it, and if I was 30 with a wife and kids, I probably would never have left. Mm-hmm. But I had some money saved up. I had a couple of buddies that were going to let me move in for couple hundred bucks a month rent, and so I kind of took a leap of faith, and I was going to start waiting at Applebee's. Luckily, I was able to get a $18,000 a year job as the guy who coordinates travel and monitors academics, and from that point on, I held every job in that office until the head coaching job, which I thought was really good in helping me develop as a coach and person who understood every role in the office.
But was this one of those situations where you took the job at Eli Lilly knowing that in your heart of hearts, you know, you wanted to be a basketball coach?
Yeah, I think I figured it out right towards the time I was starting at Lilly. And the main reason was because of working at Butler's camp. I worked for 4 weeks, and the assistant coach there that I was basically assigned to, that I worked under, was Thad Matta, who became the head coach, now the head coach at Ohio State. Yeah. I don't know how much attention we were paying to the kids, but we were talking a lot about basketball, and I had a great time doing it. And so we, you know, when he got the job at Butler, he was kind enough to say, hey, you can quit your job at Lilly, come over here and volunteer if you want.
Well, you know, it's such an interesting story, especially in this season of commencement speeches and kids leaving college and going out, and they're often told, follow your heart, follow your dreams. It's not always so easy. And I'm just thinking of your situation with a real job at a real pharmaceutical company, and yet you kind of took the plunge. You kind of did that. You kind of followed
your heart. Yeah, it's, you know, my parents thought I was crazy, but they were very supportive. And then, you know, my girlfriend, who's now my wife, who we've been together since the mid-90s, was supportive. And she was, at the same time, kind of going through her own transition of, she was working at a not-for-profit locally in Indianapolis but was applying to law school. It was really good. We kind of felt like it was a time for both of us to experiment, both of us to, she moved to Cleveland, I lived in Indy. We stayed together from a long distance relationship, but at the same time, I think we were very supportive of each other's desire to go try something new and see if it fit.
Well, Brad Stevens, last question. Let me bring it back to the Celtics and next season. Will you do anything differently in season two?
Well, I think every season you do stuff differently. It's hard to answer that specifically without knowing exactly what our roster will be.
Sure.
And so once that gets settled, I'll have a better idea tactically. Although technically I think we've got a good idea of what we want to do right now. We've been working on it since the season ended. We've done some what I would consider to be very deep analysis of the season. And, you know, hopefully we can take what didn't go well, make it good, and take what did go well and try to bottle that up for more minutes than not.
Well, Brad Stevens, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and good luck.
Thank you.
Have a great summer.
Thank you.
Brad Stevens reflecting on his first year as head coach of the Boston Celtics.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.